You're listening to KBOO. Welcome to The Film Show, your show about the local and independent film and video scene.
I'm S.W. Conser.
And I'm Jen Chavez. A little later in the show, we'll be visited by Rick Prelinger, the San Francisco film archivist and founder of the Prelinger Library. He's in town tomorrow night to MC the event No More Road Trips at the Northwest Film Center.
But first, we're joined live in the studio by a local collector and archivist, Eric Isaacson, the owner of Mississippi Records. And we're going to hear about the final event in his music and film series at the Hollywood Theater.
Yes, indeed. I am joined here by Eric Isaacson of Mississippi Records. On July 31st at 7:30, he'll be presenting A Cosmic and Earthly History of Recorded Music According to Mississippi Records, a film and talk presentation. Eric, thanks so much for joining me, and welcome back to The Film Show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So first off, can you tell me a little bit about the Mississippi Records Film Archive? I understand it's part of a larger archive of film, music, and photography, and the film part is what you'll be pulling 45 minutes of music footage from for your event. You're a record store, and I'm willing to bet that most people are unaware of your role as a film archivist.
Yeah, well, to call it an archive is maybe giving it too much credit. It's
Nah.
Yeah, it's really like bits and pieces I've collected since I was a teenager. There's nothing exceptionally... what it is, you know, we're in an interesting age now where people think just because something's on YouTube, it's good enough. But I guess the only strength of my archive is that I have all the best R&B clips and blues clips and things like you that I actually have them on high quality DVDs occasionally, you know, things like that. So I have high quality digital copies of things that you've only seen incredibly grainy, horrible copies of where you can barely hear what's happening. And on the big screen at the Hollywood, they'll look incredible. So.
Yeah, it sounds exciting. Not to spoil your presentation or anything, but who are some of the musicians in store on film that you can speak about who you have fondly described as some of the greatest musicians on earth?
Yeah, a little hyperbole for you there.
No.
Well, there's great footage of the Staple Singers, Bo Diddley, Skip James, people like this, Willie Dixon. Some of it really has... I'm sure has never been projected on a big screen before in its existence, as far as I know. I mean, maybe something happened in Europe once upon a time. A lot of it's from TV shows from the late 50s and early 60s. That's a large part of what I'm pulling from, is these strange moments where on mainstream TV shows, they would suddenly accidentally get some wild and crazy, beautiful, wonderful act that normally wouldn't be on such a stolid, horrible thing as a TV show. And, you know, these brief little moments are so powerful. So it's that kind of stuff.
Wonderful. You know, we're speaking about film of the last, you know, century. Now, music obviously existed before film, and I assume some of the archival footage you have access to dates maybe even back to the early stages of sound filmmaking. Is there a parallel here that you've considered at all with the relationship between the history of recorded music and the history of film?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest things is Edison's involvement in both. I mean, he, you know, held the patent on the first 16 years of film, as well as the first 16 years of the recording medium. So he controlled everything that came out. He got to say what could and couldn't happen. And Edison was a very conservative and kind of horrible man who had a very conservative agenda, and he wouldn't allow things, his technology, to be used by people with other agendas, more liberal or... you know, life-affirming or decent agendas. I mean, Edison was a racist and anti-Semite, and he used these mediums to promote his agenda. So it was a very much controlled thing. And the whole history I tell of film, or of recorded music, could be applied to film too, where it's a story of the powers that be trying to control these mediums because they understand how powerful they are, and then the people trying to take the power back.
Yeah, you reference, of course, revolutionary American music forms in, as you say, their subsequent destruction by the powers that be. How would you say the powers that be shaped the musical genres you love, for example, blues?
Well, I mean, there's various points where, well, when you look at blues, there's a good example. You know, you have this thing where There'd be moments of openness where the market would be confused, the corporations wouldn't understand what people actually wanted, and that's when all this crazy stuff would sneak in. You know, you'd suddenly have a moment where they would not know why the things that are selling, much like when rock and roll first started, they didn't understand how to control this music or how to control these kids who are controlling the market. And gradually what happens is the industry always figures it out. They figure out a way to take, you know, black music, for instance, and like blues, and turn it into something a little more palpable and less dangerous, and a product that they can slop on people without it being too dangerous or too wild, you know. So that's kind of the history of that stuff. Usually it goes back and forth, and the corporations end up winning for a while, and the people take it back and make their own form, and goes back and forth like that.
It kind of sounds a little bit like pre-code Hollywood.
Yeah, definitely.
Scrambling to figure out how to regulate this crazy new thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, have you ever considered going into like filmmaking, or even just like film archivist, kind of more exploring your role as a film archivist?
Yeah, that's my first love, really. I mean, maybe even over music is film. Yeah, I love it. It's just I ended up with music because I guess it's cheaper and easier to deal with, and making a film is an incredible endeavor as opposed to making a record, which is quite easy. So, in the future, I would love to get into making films. Maybe not so much archiving film, but definitely making films is a dream of mine. Before I die, I plan on making at least one, maybe even two.
That's funny. That kind of sounds like my experience. I wanted to go into documentary filmmaking, and I figured, hey, doing only the sound part might be a little bit easier on the production. So here I am in radio, and I love it.
Your fate chooses you.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. So the stated aim of your presentation is to illustrate the entire cosmic and earthly history of recorded music. And of course, we've talked about some of the blues musicians and other musicians that you will be playing film footage of. But by entire, you mean dating back literally to the birth of the first star in the universe. I understand you'll be touching upon the patterns of stars and those elsewhere in nature. Can you talk about their relation to the early history of music?
Yeah, I don't want to give too much away, but
no, not at all.
But the whole idea was, there's this idea that, you know, recorded music, now there's a new thing called archaeoacoustics, where you can kind of go back and I don't want to go too deep into it because we have so limited time, but let's just say there are ways we can read the sounds of the past. So I want to go into that first, and why not go all the way back to the beginning of stars as the first example of something we can actually read what it might have sounded like when a star was born. So it may sound totally absurd, but that's where we're starting. And then we end in the 80s, you know, because I don't know what to do after that.
Yeah, so. You termed it as the dark ages of the 1980s.
Yeah.
How would you characterize the 80s as the dark ages?
Oh, I you know, it's a personal prejudice. I mean, I had to grow up in the 80s. And, you know, there's this thing about how music is, whether you like it or not, is based 90% on context and 10% on content. So, you know, I grew up in the 80s, didn't have the best time in my childhood. So it's just the soundtrack to a nightmare to me. And, you know, whenever I hear it, it just sounds like corporate schlock that I can't stand. And, you know, it's a personal prejudice, and I understand that a lot of great things happen too. But in the presentation I'm giving, I definitely skewer the 80s and talk about it as a very controlled and awful time.
Yes, well, it is the history of music according to Mississippi Records at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I get to be as extreme as I want to be.
Indeed. Well, what you say sounds absurd, sounds fascinating to me.
Oh,
just so you know. Also, and I know I don't want you to have to give too much away, but you said you'll be touching upon the untold early history of recording technology. You mentioned a bit about this, but I wanted to ask about cat pianos.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of unfair that I mentioned that in a little press blurb, because I don't really talk too much about the cat piano. It's going to be very disappointing for the people who come specifically just for information about the cat piano.
Well, that's okay. What better venue to discuss it than right here on
right
the radio?
Right here and now. Well, there was a guy who also created a lot of early models for recording technology that were never actually made, but he drew up the blueprints. And one of his other inventions was the cat piano, which I couldn't resist mentioning and showing illustrations of, which was a essentially a piano where you stick cats in these little boxes. It's really a torture device. And you press, as you press the keys, it pokes the cats and they meow in different keys. You know, you find, you have to go looking through hundreds of cats to find the right cats to get each key. And why are we talking about this? This is horrible.
Sounds like quite a process. How long does that date back to?
That's from the 1600s.
Okay. Well,
yeah, late 1600s.
I suppose we can thank the gods of music that we're no longer relying upon cat torture devices create our music.
Yeah, talk about dark ages, huh?
Yeah, indeed.
They played this thing in a church once too. It was they got all these cats and they had them play what was the song? It was I can't remember now, but it was a hymn. And what a horrible thing. Could you imagine you go to church and a guy drags this piano out and starts torturing cats in front of you to sing a gospel hymn? Jeez.
I cannot imagine. Well,
kind of God?
Well, luckily we've come leaps and bounds from that era. So from history to the future, I suppose, according to the event details I looked at, you have in store some hopeful messages about the future. In fact, the stated ultimate goal of this presentation is to give the audience a sense that anything is possible and art is worth doing, which sounds wonderful, by the way. can you expand a little bit upon this goal and the hope that you intend to inspire?
Well, to be perfectly honest, this has been troubling because I'm still actually writing the very end of this, and I was editing the end of it recently with my friend Chris, and the ending I have right now is so horrific, you know, in the 80s, that he had to, while we were editing, he had to turn away from the monitor and tell me when it was over and over again, because he just could not watch this footage we were editing together. I'm not going to say what it is because that'll ruin it, but suffice it to say I had the horror. So after that, it was very terrifying. I was like, I can't end it like this. This is too horrible. So so I've been meditating on positivity and trying to find a positive message that I can end it on. I think I found it. I don't want to give it away just yet, I think it's overall, I want the tone of the presentation, despite what I just said about the nightmarish ending I've planned that made my friend unable to even look at a monitor. that I want the overall tone to be the kind of thing where you learn so much that you didn't know about the history of something that you think you know, that suddenly you look at everything around you a little differently and say, well, wait a minute, do I really know the history of this and that? Because really the history of recorded music, as I see it, I'm not going to be talking about, you know, I'm just going to be that. And then the Rolling Stones came along in 1962 and Robert Johnson recorded, you know, there's none of that. The whole point of it is to show that there's an undercurrent, an understory that's a lot more cosmic and a lot more about the general human condition, about culture and about our development and our evolution as human beings than just, you know, all these names and dates and places and people who are kind of interesting and wore funny hats or whatever. So I'm hoping that it imparts a sort of more general sense of wonder in people, but you know, that's a lot to ask and I may not raise to the occasion, but it will at least be funny.
Good. Well, funny and hopeful can go hand in hand, I think.
Yeah, sometimes.
Before the show, you mentioned a little bit about you're potentially going to be touring with some of this material. Can you speak anything about that?
Yeah, after doing the show at the Hollywood on the 31st, I'm going to Europe for 2 months and just showing this thing all over Europe. You know, I think we have like, I don't know, 40 or 50 shows, something like that. So it's a lot of shows. And I did this last year with the presentation we talked about, and it was really fun. I did 3 months in Europe and just kind of wandered around and showed my footage and gave my little talks and showed my little slides, and it's a great excuse to travel.
What did it have, I mean, specific interest to Europeans that because it was about an American, you know, art form, or was that an interesting experience talking about American history to Europeans?
Absolutely, yeah. It was it was definitely most people who showed up, their interest in it was, there was a little bit of exoticism in what I was presenting, you know, and there was even times when I was worried, particularly when you go to a place like Denmark or something like that, where I was worried, oh, is this being looked at as a novelty, or sort of they don't understand that this is deep, heavy art, and they're just kind of looking at me as some kind of clown, and this footage I'm showing is some kind of exotica. But overall, I'd say Europe actually respects American culture more than America respects American culture. Like in Europe, there's, you know, it's a tired statement, but it's true. There's more of an appreciation for the best things in America and Europe than there is in America. And that's a fact. I mean, I defy anyone to show me proof that that's not true.
Great. Well, before we go, can you just tell me how folks can find your shop and or find more info about Mississippi Records in relation to the Hollywood series or in general?
Yeah, well, the Hollywood series, you can just go to the Hollywood Theater's website, and there's always updates on whatever we're doing there. We do a monthly program there that ends for the year this time, but with this thing on the 31st, but resumes in January. And as far as Mississippi Records, we're not online at all. We don't exist online. So there's a physical store over in North Portland you can visit. You know, we have like records and record stores occasionally on our record label, but that's pretty much the only evidence of us existing.
Where's the address of your shop in North Portland?
It's 5202 North Albina.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining me this morning. I've been speaking with Eric Isaacson, the proprietor of Mississippi Records and the host of its music and film series at the Hollywood Theater. The next event, again coming up July 31st at 7:30 p.m., focuses on a cosmic and earthly history of recorded music, according to Mississippi Records. More info at hollywoodtheater.org. Thanks for dropping by the studio and coming back on the film show, Eric.
Oh, thanks for having me so much.
And thanks, Jen. You're listening to The Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Concert. I'm here with Jen Chavez.
Yes, indeed. Now we'll be visited by Rick Prelinger, the San Francisco film archivist and founder of the Prelinger Library. He's in town tomorrow night to MC the event No More Road Trips at the Northwest Film Center.
Yes, right now we are on the line with film archivist Rick Prelinger. He is in San Francisco, but he's coming to Portland this very weekend. He's going to be at the Film Center tomorrow, Friday the 27th. Rick Prelinger, welcome to the film show.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So tell us about this screening that you're going to have.
So I'm going to be screening a new film of mine, which is a feature-length film. It's called No More Road Trips, with a question mark at the end of it. And what's No More Road Trips? It's a dream journey across the country from Atlantic to Pacific, made completely out of home movies. That's other people's home movies. We looked at about 5,000 to select for this film. And this film's a couple of things. For one thing, it asks the question, is travel as we know it over? Have we reached peak travel? And I was interested in this idea because I saw that younger people are putting off getting their licenses, gas is more expensive, the road trip is kind of the grand journey of, you know, migration and self-discovery isn't quite what it used to be. I started to wonder, is the archetypal journey changed from being the trip across country to the trip into this country? So it's the film visits all sorts of places, both familiar and unfamiliar, in its attempt to recreate the experience of driving cross-country. But maybe even more important, this is not a real movie. What this is an event, because while the film shows, the audience is invited to identify what you see on the screen, to ask questions, to talk, to discuss this question of peak travel, to dispute other people's ideas or identification. In other words, imagine a boxing match, or imagine the Elizabethan Theater, where the audience was not shy about telling the actors what they thought. And that's what No More Road Trips is going to be like. So the audience talks their way across country.
So the audience is encouraged to talk during the movie or just afterwards?
No, the audience talks their way through. Like I said, this is not a real movie. This is a fully participatory experience. The world is filled with documentaries, you know, that we watch in silence. But the audience makes the soundtrack. I should say the audience is the soundtrack. This film is incomplete without people talking.
And you'll be there for a Q&A or to continue the discussion once the movie's over?
Yeah, I'll be an MC. You know, I'll talk about what we're seeing. But I hope I'm not the only voice in the room. This is about the, I think it's the 15th screening, screened around the country, and it's screened in Europe and Australia. And when it works, you have a loud, vocal, exuberant audience. And that's what I hope we'll have in Portland.
This sounds more like a live theater piece than a movie per se, because you have that interactive element between the filmmaker and the audience.
Exactly. No two shows are the same. Nothing is scripted. It's completely up to the audience what it becomes.
Now, being a veteran of several road trips myself, going back, many years, one thing that I've noticed is just how alike so many small towns have become. Whereas, you know, back when I was a kid, in the back of my parents' station wagon, we would see a funky old town in the Southwest that might have a general store, might have a lizard zoo, something like that. It's kind of all Walmarts and Carl's Jr.'s now.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. There's no monoculture in my film, because really the latest home movie that I found that I could use was in the 70s, and it goes back to the 20s. So there's a lot of place. There's a great deal of uniqueness in the places that we see and we visit. And I agree with you that the landscape along the freeways can get pretty monotonous, except in Oregon, you know, where you've got the dinosaurs and heaven on earth and all kinds of cool stuff along Highway 5.
And on Highway 101 sometimes, yes.
Yeah, 101, exactly, on the coast. But you know something, once you get off the interstates, you get away from those built-up areas right at the exits, and you start going on the two lanes and visit the towns, it's quite different. There still is a real sense of regionalism in America. People are quite attuned to where they come from, and they've got a real sense of local identity. And I no longer think that the U.S. has all been, you know, converted into the same kind of place because of satellite TV. There's a lot of differences.
Well, your archive, which you've been building for many, many years, the Prelinger Archive, is mostly an analog kind of preservation effort. So you have a variety of films going back that aren't just home movies, that might be industrials, that might even be some of the early film stocks that didn't preserve very well.
So for years, I collected industrial, advertising, educational films, films made by governments, and all sorts of stuff, and that was a huge collection. It was 200,000 cans. Most of that went to Library of Congress, and these days I collect special industrials, you know, ones that are, I don't know, the phone company, Chevrolet, pretty interesting stuff. And we've done a bunch of preservation. We've preserved nitrate film, and we've preserved old color that was fading. And but we're mostly a home movie collection. And I think part of that is just that I get a huge thrill out of material that was made by ordinary people, you know, or no focus group ever got involved with what should be in the frame. And that's become cinema to me in a lot of ways. So I'm a little unusual in that sense. I love the unpredictability of home movies. I love the honesty. I love the affection with which people photograph things that they cared about. The more home movies you look at, you realize that absolutely everything was photographed. And you're going to say, well, maybe so-and-so wasn't. And I tell you it is. Just a matter of finding it. I do my local history events here in San Francisco and in Detroit and in Oakland. And one of the things I've found is that if you're persistent and patient, sooner or later, you will find that everything was photographed.
You know, it's hard to believe that it's only been a few decades since the switch over to digital happened. Yeah. As far as film and video goes, because nowadays, well, you can document just about anything for the cost of the electricity on your cell phone. But back then, it was special events that got chronicled, because you only had maybe a 3-minute reel of film that had to be sent away to be developed and come back, it would be a big event to show these.
Yep, absolutely. This is a funny transition. If you look at a home movie, people take a quick shot, and then they let the shutter go, and then they take a quick shot, and it's kind of staccato. And today, you know, just let the camera roll. Really, as long as you can hold your arm up until your arm gets tired holding up your phone, that's the effective limit.
Another big difference between then and now is that archivists like yourself, you had this big collection that was in demand, certain historical artifacts that people might want to slug into a documentary, and it would be expensive to get that footage out to somebody. Nowadays, it just seems like everything's out on YouTube, so that must be an incredibly different environment from decades ago when you started out.
Well, you know, for years, I sold stock footage for a living, but then worthy people, you know, community media makers, artists, people doing social political work, wanted access to our stuff, and they didn't have a budget. And I pretty much always said yes. but it costs just as much to give away footage to, you know, to service a freebie as it did to service a Coca-Cola commercial. And then I came out here in California and partnered with Internet Archive, archive.org, this nonprofit, and we started to put our collection up online. And at the moment, we've got, I think, about 6,800 items online. And they've been viewed or downloaded, I'm going to say, around 100 million times. And that's just incredible. I mean, these are obscure films. The only one most people have ever heard of is Duck and Cover.
Oh, yes.
The defense film. But most of these films are far more specialized and obscure, and yet they're used by countless people for countless new projects, for screenings, for showings in cafes and schools and churches, for public access, used on public radio, community radio. Most archivists don't get so lucky. Most archivists don't get a chance to have their holdings so freely used. So in that respect, I think the Internet's great. And you know what else they propagate? We put something up on archive.org and people put it on YouTube, and gradually it gets disassociated with us. It just becomes part of our cultural infrastructure.
And that's okay with you?
Of course. That way we have much more control over our material, paradoxically, because if our wish is for it to be used, this is the best way.
Well, Rick Prelinger, will be delighted to see you here in Portland at the Northwest Film Center on Friday, the 27th of June. The film is No More Road Trips with a question mark, and it's archival footage from dozens and dozens of sources, and the audience is encouraged to respond while the screening is in progress, and you'll be around for a Q&A and a little
certainly
discussion
well
afterwards.
Certainly will.
Well, thank you, and we'll look forward to seeing you.
Thanks so much, Conch.
And now back to Jen.
Thank you, Conch. Before we go, we'd like to just share a couple events with you on our monthly film calendar. The Hollywood Theater has two animated events coming up soon, one this Saturday, June 28th, and another on July 12th, both from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. The Mobile Animation Lab offers one-day workshops on the fundamentals of animation to youth aged 7 to 11, culminating in the creation of stop-motion shorts. To learn more, visit hollywoodtheater.org.
On July 3rd at the Clinton Street Theater, Portland-based Italian animator Luca Di Piero will showcase nearly 20 short works of cutout animation in her program Paper Circus. The 7 p.m. screening will feature live accompaniment by the experimental Italian band Father Murphy. Details can be found at cstpdx.com.
On Sunday, July 6th at 8 p.m., documentary called Shift Change will be airing on OPB all over the state. It's an inspiring doc about worker-owned and managed co-ops, and it will be screened at the Hollywood Theater as well. More info about this film at shiftchange.org.
On July 10th at the Northwest Film Center, they'll host an evening with Orland Nutt at 7 p.m. The night will feature a retrospective of the young filmmaker's experimental short works spanning over a decade, as well as his newest film, Bear of Heaven. More info at nwfilm.org.
On July 11th, the Northwest Film Center and the Oregon Historical Society will co-present The Battered Bastards of Baseball, a nostalgic documentary about the renegade independent baseball team, the Portland Mavericks, which was started by Bonanza actor Bing Russell in the 70s after Portland lost the Beavers. The show starts at 8 p.m. and directors Chapman and McLean Way will be in attendance to introduce and discuss the film. To learn more, visit nwfilm.org.
From July 18th through the 20th, a drive-in theater will pop up at Ziddell Yards on the west side, under the Ross Island Bridge, kicking off with a Friday night double feature, Purple Rain at 7:30 and Mean Streets at 11:30. The weekend series is being co-presented by the Northwest Film Center, and a complete list of films and other info is available at nwfilm.org.
On July 24th, the Portland Eco Film Festival continues at the Hollywood with Eco Shorts, with a program addressing issues such as endangered Northwest fish, fracking, conservation, and urban farming. The screening starts at 7:30, and the festival continues on with monthly screenings through September. More info at hollywoodtheater.org/ecofilm.
And the Northwest Film Center's summer outdoor screening series, Top Down Rooftop Cinema, launches again with Notorious at 8 p.m. Events are at 8 and continue every Thursday through August atop the Hotel Deluxe parking garage on Southwest 15th and Yamhill. A complete list of films can be found at nwfilm.org.
And lastly, at the Hollywood Theater on July 26th, the Portland Latino Gay Pride Festival will present the documentary Transvisible, Bambi Salcedo's story, following the life of the trans Latina activist and community leader. Show begins at 8 p.m. To learn more, visit hollywoodtheater.org or latinogaypridepdx.com.
Well, that's about all we have for you on the film calendar. We'd like to thank our guests today on the film show, Eric Isaacson from Mississippi Records Music and Film Series, and Rick Prelinger from archive.org.
Thanks also to the Oregon Media Production Association for their ongoing support and collaboration, and thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. The audio for this show will be available later today on our archive page, kboo.fm/thefilmshow.
Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.
You're listening to news headlines at noon for Thursday, June 26th on KBOO. The 10th Circuit Court of Appeals judges brought Utah that much closer to allowing same-sex marriages on Wednesday when it ruled that states cannot ban such unions. However, it placed a stay immediately after putting a hold on further unions. The original ruling against the same-sex marriage ban occurred December 20th of last year when U.S. District Judge Robert J. Shelby struck it down, opening a flood of couples rushing to get married before the U.S. Supreme Court intervened and placed a hold in order for the 10th Circuit to hear the state's appeal. Utah is one of the most conservative states and will probably appeal the ruling, taking the case to the Supreme Court. For now, same-sex marriage proponents count this ruling as a victory. Though the school district is getting a 9% increase in spending this year and plans to fill 350 teaching positions, 27 educational assistance jobs hang in the balance. They have not yet been assigned positions